Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Theodore Judah, the visionary who dreamed of building it, called the notion the most magnificent project ever conceived. The effort, said General William Tecumseh Sherman, would be a work of giants. They were speaking of the building of America's first transcontinental railroad, and that is the subject of our conversation today with historian Stephen Ambrose. But before we get to Professor Ambrose, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1898, Pierre-Marie Curie announced to the world that they had identified the trace element radium, the most powerful radioactive substance of its time. While it emitted tremendous amounts of heat in its salt form, burning human skin on contact, radium was soon used in small doses to cure certain skin cancers. During the First World War and after her husband's death, Marie Curie prevented the radiological equipment in her lab from falling into German hands. She also recruited nearly 150 nurses and trained them as radiological equipment operators to treat wounded French soldiers returning from the front. Later in life, Madame Curie gained celebrity status throughout the world for her and her husband's groundbreaking scientific discovery and was awarded small amounts of pure radium by American Presidents Harding and Hoover. Ironically, it may have been her exposure to the elements she discovered that caused her death in 1934 of leukemia. Turning to history in the news, the man believed to have stolen the World War II German encoding device Enigma from a museum in London has been arrested. Nazi forces used the Enigma, which resembles a manual typewriter, during the war to encrypt and conceal top-secret messages. The Bletchley Park Museum, from which the machine was stolen last April, is the same location where a team of code breakers cracked the Enigma code. The stolen device surfaced in a London mailroom in October, but it was missing many of its rotors. Investigators hope that the person they have arrested will lead them to the missing parts. Former Navy pilot A. Scott Crossfield was recently honored in a ceremony at the National Air and Space Museum. While the award recognized Crossfield as a lifelong contributor to the advancement of naval aviation, he is most remembered as the first person to exceed Mach 2 speed. Crossfield explained that it was revenge as much as aviation advancement that first drove him to even attempt such a feat. The Air Force had rejected him after he failed a physical. And when an Air Force pilot broke the sound barrier, or Mach 1, Crossfield urged his superiors to give him the chance to fly at the then incomparable speed of 1,320 miles per hour for the Navy, which he did in 1953 above the California desert. You're listening to Talking History. Next to winning the Civil War and abolishing slavery, building the first transcontinental railroad was the greatest achievement of the American people in the 19th century. So writes our guest today, historian Stephen Ambrose, in his latest book, Nothing Like It in the World, The Men Who Built the Transcontinental Railroad, 1863 to 1869, published by Simon & Schuster. Ambrose is likely well known to most of you for his biographies of Eisenhower and Nixon and his books on D-Day and the Lewis and Clark Expedition, among many others. But I should note as well that earlier this year, Professor Ambrose received the Department of Defense's Medal for Distinguished Public Service. Welcome, Professor Ambrose, and congratulations on the medal and on your new book.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate that.
What made you decide to do a book on the building of the Transcontinental Railroad?
Well, I had finished a book on Lewis and Clark, and they had been sent to find an old water route to the Pacific. And they came back, and they said to the president, Mr. Jefferson, it's not there. There's the Rocky Mountains. And so the American people decided, we'll build a railroad. And within less than a man's lifetime after Lewis and Clark returned, they did it. And I wanted to find out how. In 1839, there were no railroads in the United States. 30 years later, in 1869, we expand the continent. The first peoples ever to do that. And so I wanted to find out, how was that done?
So there is a connection there with your Lewis and Clark book. Okay, that's interesting. But yours is not the first book on the building of the railroad. What makes yours different?
It won't be the last either.
No, I'm sure.
I bring a fresh perspective to it. That is, I'm writing from the point of view of the year 2000, and I've got a different attitude towards the financiers who built the railroad and who were accused of all kinds of swindles, and that was more or less correct, but there's a lot more to the story than that. But I bring to it a sense of appreciation for how hard these men worked. Now, the businessmen, nobody ever thinks a businessman is working, but they sure as hell did. And then the Chinese and the Irish on the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific and everybody else. I mean, this work crew, more than 10,000 on each railroad, came from all over the world. And the amount of work that they did just astonishes us today. I grew up, I was born in 1936. I used to milk cows by hand. I used to make hay by hand. I've done a lot of hard physical labor in my time. But I didn't work anywhere near as hard as these guys did. Out there with those sledgehammers driving in the spikes to attaching the rails to the ties from, Nebraska can be pretty hot in the summertime. It can get awfully cold in the wintertime, and that wind can howl. And they were out there every day, from first light until the fading of the last light, working. So I'm impressed very much so by that, and I wanted to find out how they lived, what they did in their off time, what the hell on wheels were like, how the surveyors laid out the line, how the graders made the bed for the line, how the people, the men putting down the ties did that, how they put down the rails, how they spiked in the rails, how they measured the rails, how did they do it? That's what I wanted to know.
This also seems to be a connection or a tie to your undaunted courage in that you seem to celebrate labor and human achievement there just as much. This seems to be a concern of yours or something you like to write about.
Well, it certainly is something I like to write about, and of course it's a concern of mine, as I think it is of everybody's. And I want people to be aware that things change. Lewis and Clark, for example, went up the Missouri River. Now, you ever try to paddle upstream in the Missouri River, even for just a half an hour, and you realize how exhausting that is? Well, they did it all day long, day after day, for weeks, months, through the whole season. In the same way, what it did to the back to be driving in spikes all day long, or to be handling those rails 60 pounds apiece, or to be laying down those ties, or to be digging for the making of the grade. I don't know quite how to put it. I mean, I was an athlete in my youth, and I'm impressed by people that can do things. But I'm most impressed by people who can make things or make things happen.
I think you put it well, and you're right. This is a part of the project that we often don't read about in the textbooks, so that's good. You mentioned a little bit earlier, would you like to elaborate a bit on who conceived of this project? Where did the
My editor, Alice Mayhew, said, you ought to do the Transcontinental next. And I said, oh, Alice, I don't know. I mean, I was trained as a 19th century historian, and I knew a fair amount about that. I'm not a business historian. And I'm not a labor historian. I'm an American historian. That's what I do. And I said, oh, Alice, I don't know. I mean, these guys, they were all robber barons, and they took all this land that the government gave them, and they got filthy rich out of building this railroad, and then they used that money to dominate politics in California and even nationally and to build these two great corporations. And I don't know that I'm interested in that. And she said, give it a try. And so I said, well, give me 6 months to read. And I spent 6 months reading the basic literature and came to the conclusion that if I wanted to find out how they built that railroad, I was going to have to write my own book.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, in your book you mentioned it, but to the effect, and this I thought was a surprise to me anyway, where we always read about the corruption in the construction of the railroad. You say that essentially that the railroad couldn't have been built without the democratic political system, and in another place, enlightened politicians. Generally, we see this as a corrupt bargain. How do you come down on this side of the argument?
Probably by comparison. We did it so much faster than the Canadians did. and the Canadians were hiring American engineers, and they had their government behind it. We did it so much faster than the Russians built the Trans-Siberian, and so much better. How quickly it was done. Now, I was taught as a college student and then as a graduate student about the corruption and about how shoddy everything was. That's bull. These guys didn't. They started the Central Pacific in 1863. They didn't start in Omaha until 1866. And by 1869, May of 1869, they're done. They're driving in the Golden Spike on May 10th. And that's astonishing.
Did that
now, there was a lot of corruption involved, no question.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys got caught, and Oakes Ames was driven out of Congress, and Dr. Ant lost his fortune, and so on. But these guys that were the financiers or the big four on the Central Pacific risked all. They put their fortunes into this. And for a long time, it looked like they had lost everything. But they got that railroad built, and they did it faster than any other way would have done it. Had the government undertaken to build that railroad, which there was some talk about the government ought to build it, I guarantee you it would have taken twice as long and been half as good.
So the government wasn't directly involved. They really kind of set up a contest here between the Central
Pacific. A race, that's right. The government set up a race. The more you get a certain, you get alternate sections of land for every mile track that you lay. You get a certain amount of government bonds for every 20 miles that you've laid. Those bonds were loans, by the way. They were not gifts. And those loans were paid back by the railroads in the 30-year time period that they were given to pay it back. But the Congress, that's what I meant by only a democratic political system. The Congress set this up as a race because the Congress, being the representatives of the people, knew that if there had been a national referendum right after the Civil War on do you want this railroad built fast or do you want it built well, that is, with the highest quality of construction and take your time, boys, and save money wherever and whenever you can, or build the damn thing. Whatever it cost. If you'd have had such a referendum as that, by 97% or more, the American people would have voted, build it fast. Get that railroad done. And they did.
If you had to single out one or two people that you would give most credit to in the construction, even the conceiving of this, who would you single out?
Well, Theodore Judah, first of all, for the Central Pacific. He's the man who had the vision that we can get over or through, and they ended up going through on tunnels, the Sierra Nevada Mountains. On the Union Pacific side, Abraham Lincoln, who got the whole thing started when across the river from Omaha at Council Bluffs, where he was running for president, not announced yet, but 1859, he met Grenville Dodge, who he was told knew more about railroads than anybody else in the country, and Lincoln's very first question to him was, where should the Pacific Railroad run? And Dodge pointed straight west, said right up the Platte Valley. And from that instant, Lincoln was committed and did everything that he could, which was an awful lot, to make certain that that railroad got built. Then Grenville Dodge, who was head of the Civil War general, and then became head chief engineer for the Union Pacific, and William Tecumseh Sherman and Ulysses S. Grant. Without Lincoln, without Grant, without Sherman, without Dodge, without Judah, there wouldn't have been any railroad. And we'd still be arguing in Congress over where it ought to be and how it ought to be built.
What impact did the completion of the railroad in 1869 have on the nation's development?
It would be hard to measure. It was so great. It was the biggest thing that happened, except for winning the Civil War and abolishing slavery. The Congress decreed that all the rails have to be made in the United States. What an impact that had on Pennsylvania. The locomotives were built on the East Coast. The railroad cars were built on the East Coast. The impetus to industrialism, the beginning right after the Civil War of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, it is due to the railroad. The railroad conquered distance and conquered time. Before the railroad, to get from Omaha to San Francisco took at least a month, almost certainly more, and cost a minimum of $1,000. When they drove in that spike at Promontory Summit, you could go from Omaha to San Francisco in 5 days. So fast, they used to say, you don't even have time to take a bath. And at a cost of $100, and you could ship grain or minerals or coal or lumber or steel or whatever at an infinitesimal rate as compared to putting it on wagons and hauling it all the way out to Salt Lake and then on to San Francisco. The Transcontinental Railroad and the ones that followed, because they had shown that it could be done, and we pretty quickly had the Northern Pacific and the Great Northern and the Southern Pacific and so on, they made modern America. And they kept California in the Union at a critical point when there was some sentiment in California to follow the South and have secession. And that's only the beginning of what the railroad did. One thing the railroad did that we all live with, it affected our language, of course. The train is leaving the station, that sort of thing. And that illustrates time. Before the coming of the railroad, everybody had their own time. That is, noon in Omaha came when the sun was at its peak. And noon in Omaha would be different from noon in Des Moines, which would come earlier, or different from noon out in Cheyenne, which is going to come later than it does at Omaha. But with the coming of the Transcontinental Railroad, people quickly discovered, we got to have some standard time around here. Or the train coming from Grand Island is going to be running headed east, is going to run into the train headed west from Omaha. So it's 12 noon in Omaha has got to be the same as it is at Grand Island, or it is out in Kearney, Nebraska, and so on. So standard time came about as a result of these railroads. But most of all, the railroads made it possible for people to move. And there is no characteristic more important to the American people than movement. Being able to go and set up in central Nebraska and become a farmer, or to go out to Cheyenne, or to go on to San Francisco, or to go east. I don't care what direction they're going in, to be able to move. The railroads made that possible.
And that would certainly lead us back to the opening of what made this the greatest achievement, wouldn't it? Because its impact was far-reaching.
Oh, certainly.
Well, I must ask before we close, you only have 2 minutes. I at least am curious, given all that you've written, where are you going from here? What's next?
I'm writing a book right now on the 15th Air Force in Italy in the Second World War. And I'm about three-quarters done with that. And then when I finish that, I'm going to do a book on the citizen soldiers in the Pacific.
You're, in a sense, getting back to your roots again, or where you began.
Well, I'm curious. I want to know how the hell they did that in the 15th Air Force. And I haven't written before about Marines, so I want to do the citizen soldiers of the Pacific and the Army of the Pacific as well.
Well, we'll watch for it and try to get you back on the show as soon as it comes out.
All right, great.
Thank you, Professor Ambrose, and once again, congratulations.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Stephen Ambrose, author of Nothing Like It in the World, The Men Who Built the Transcontinental Railroad, 1863 to 1869, published by Simon & Schuster. And this is Talking History. Welcome back. For our site of the week, we have chosen the place where the building of the Transcontinental Railroad was completed. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Golden Spike National Historic Site, located at Promontory Point, Utah, marks the place where the last spike was driven in for the completion of the first Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. While at the park, you can take a tour of the area, experience living history programs, including reenactments of the momentous event. Fulton Spike National Historic Site is home to the steam locomotives Jupiter and No. 119. These engines are fully functional replicas of the original locomotives that met there on May 10, 1869 for the Wedding of the Rails ceremony. You can also learn about the people who helped build the railroad and see archaeological artifacts, construction schedules, and steam locomotive demonstrations. The 2,700-acre park is open year-round.
Turning to our op-ed for this week, we switch gears from the building of the first transcontinental railroad to another important historical issue. The United States spent most of the 20th century resisting any attempts on the part of socialists to influence American domestic policy. Why? And why, when so many countries moved in that direction, were we successful in preventing the implementation of any socialist programs of consequence? That is the subject of this week's op-ed by Gary Marks. Marks, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina in Seymour Martin Lipset, are the authors of It Didn't Happen Here, Why Socialism Failed in the United States.
The logic of Marxism demanded that America, the most advanced capitalist country, should also be the country that produced the strongest socialist movement. The British Marxist Henry Hindman wrote in 1904 that, just as North America is today the most advanced country economically and socially, so it will be the first in which socialism will find open and legal expression. The leader of the American Socialist Party, Daniel de Leon, proclaimed in 1906, "If my reading of history is correct, the prophecy of Marx will be fulfilled, and America will ring the downfall of capitalism the world over." It didn't happen. The U.S. Socialist Party has never received more than 6% of the vote in presidential elections and has never won more than a couple of seats in Congress. Parties calling themselves socialist, social democratic, labor, or communist have been major forces in every democratic country in the world, with the exception of the United States. The U.S. has been the only Western democracy dominated exclusively by parties sympathetic to liberal capitalism. The inability of American socialists to create a durable labor or socialist party is not a historical quirk of a bygone era. On the contrary, it's a powerful influence on the present. Had socialists managed to forge such a party or capture the Democratic Party as successfully as the Goldwater and Reagan movements captured the Republican, the United States would almost certainly not be the only advanced democracy in the world with no system of universal health insurance and no system of universal child support. We might not have had levels of income inequality and relative poverty that are almost triple those of other rich nations. Why did we go down one path and not the other? Careful comparison of the United States with other societies suggests that some popular explanations don't pass muster. State repression, for example, cannot explain the failure of socialism in America. Even during World War I and during the McCarthy era, repression here was not as intense as it was in several European countries during the 19th century. And in these countries, repression succeeded only in making the socialist cause more popular. A more convincing explanation begins with the exceptional character of American society, politics, and culture. The distinctive character of American culture, and in particular anti-statism, diminished the appeal of socialism for the mass of American workers. The electoral system for selecting a president, which aggregates votes throughout the country, hurt the Socialist Party, just as it is hurting the Greens today. The American working class, made up mostly of immigrants, was riven by ethnic, racial, and religious hostilities. Finally, American socialists failed to build an alliance with labor unions. These four factors, American values, political structure, immigration, and the split between the Socialist Party and mainstream unions, hold the key to why socialists failed in America.
You've been listening to Gary Marks, author of It Didn't Happen Here, Why Socialism Failed in the United States. This is Talking History. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, The Jewish Museum in New York City has opened an exhibit that takes an in-depth look at Morocco, where Jews and Muslims have lived together peacefully for thousands of years. Morocco, Jews and Art in a Muslim Land builds a panorama of Jewish Moroccan life through an array of magnificent tiles, jewelry, costumes, ceremonial objects, paintings, and documentary photos. It runs through February 11th, but call the Jewish Museum in New York City for further information. And it isn't too soon to mark your calendar for this year's television programs on the history surrounding Christmas. On December 25th, the History Channel will run three special presentations. History of the Holidays, Christmas Unwrapped, provides a history of Christmas traditions in various parts of the world. Time Machine, the 12 Apostles, tells the story of the lives of the followers of Jesus. And another Time Machine program, Biblical Disasters, gives us the historical record on the various earthquakes, floods, and other disasters accounted for in the Hebrew Bible. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week, just in time for Christmas. We will talk about the history of toys. Until next week, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.